Do I have her?
Bill Saunders.
Tom Waller.
Linda Johnston.
Ed Carpenter.
I guess we rise and we'll pledge allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, has everyone had a chance to review the meeting minutes? Any comments? Discussion?
I move they be accepted as proposed.
I second the motion.
All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Minutes are approved. It says public comments now.
What'd you do with that? You know, just open it up. Kate, there could be someone here that just wants to talk that has not on our agenda.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with our invited guests.
So we'll open it up for public comments. Anybody have anything they'd like to talk about? Well, we'll move on then to Joel McCarroll with ODOT.
How you doing? I'm Joel McCarroll, and I'm ODOT's Region Traffic Manager, and I've got Dan Sopico with me, who is our Senior Traffic Analyst, and he kind of runs our Speed Zone program. So Rick had come and had asked us to come and talk about what's our process for setting speed zones, and kind of expanded that to a little bit about how drivers actually drive, because speed limits are one thing. Operating speeds are another, and they're not necessarily always related. So, is there a quicker?
No, unfortunately, you have to yell at me.
Stand up there. So, talk about what are speed limits and speed zones? How do we set them?
Here, I can run it.
Okay, why do we use prevailing speeds?
Yeah.
And then, most importantly, how do we actually get drivers to slow down?
Because some people on the end can't see because there's a chair over there. I can see.
Give away my punchline. Drivers don't actually drive based on the speed limit. So we'll just move on to the next slide. So, got sort of guidance around speed zones. Go back a long way to the 1930s. This is sort of the same principle we use today. Is looking at the speed at which 85% of the drivers are traveling under normal conditions, that's sort of the maximum critical safe speed. And the assumption here that drivers are reasonable and prudent and don't want to crash. And every time I talk about speed zones, people tell me that drivers aren't reasonable and prudent, and then I ask people to identify which of, in the audience, who is not reasonable and prudent. And nobody raises their hand. So I think it's still a pretty good assumption. So speed limits, what do? They limit the upper speed choices, so which helps reduce crash severity, encourages more uniform speeds. Roads are typically safest when drivers are traveling in a narrow band of speeds rather than a wide range of speeds. Provide a standard for law enforcement, so the enforcement can target those drivers that are truly dangerous, and then more orderly flow for traffic. So move on next slide. So brief history of Oregon speed laws. Historically, Oregon was a basic rule state, which means that the driver, that your choice of speeds is based on road conditions, road and weather conditions, not necessarily in a lot of cases, you know, a posted speed. And And then before 1974, speed zones were 55 for most highways, and the freeways were higher. And then 1974, Congress set the maximum speed at 55 miles an hour, and then was raised to 65 in 1987 on rural interstate highways. Or that should be rural interstate freeways. And then repealed the 55 national speed limit, although Oregon still retains the 65 maximum. And then 2003, legislature changed speed limits in Oregon to include all interstates and all roadways within cities. So what used to be sort of a basic rule, the driver had the duty to select a reasonable and prudent speed within city limits, which is important for Lapine. Now they're now any speed zone in the city of Lapine is a strict limit rather than a basic rule. So there's some other statutes regarding speeds. Alleys are 15 miles an hour. Business districts, school zones, and certain residential roads are 20 miles an hour. Residential districts, public parks, and ocean shores are 25 miles an hour, unless they're signed otherwise. Rural highways, 55, and then 65 for passenger vehicles, light trucks, and motorhomes on interstate highways. The law around speed zones allow road authorities to establish speed zones for others. We can have natural emergency speed zones for certain, natural disasters, for road fails or whatever. Temporary speed zones, typically you'll see those at work zones. And then there are separate rules on low volume and non-hard surface roads. The only real effect would be for city streets under 400 ADT, but typically those are also qualify either under residential or business, which would default to the 20 or 25. So let's move on. So why do we drive the speed we do? So there's a lot of factors other than the posted speed that goes into that, and it's a lot of it's roadway characteristics. How wide is the road? How wide is the shoulder? Are there sidewalks? Are there trees alongside the road? Are there parked cars? Are there buildings close to the edge of the road? How tall are those buildings? Those are all kind of factors. And then, of course, it's the driver themselves. So there's age, risk aversion, the type of car you have. There's the whole mess of things that go into your speed selection. Some of them you're conscious of, some of them you're not. The most effective way to influence operating speeds is road design. So you can see just in this picture, you've got more of a rural section where with a ditch, no sidewalk, no curb, and then you can see up here you've got curb, sidewalk, street lights, trees. All of these things are going to affect your speed, and in some cases dramatically. And so you can see in this case the posted speed is changing as you move into this environment. And so that's really when speed limits are most effective, when they reinforce the other clues that influence how you drive. So a good example is locally Terrebonne. This is what Terrebonne used to look like before we repaved it and added sidewalks about 3 years ago. And so we did some before and after speed studies, and we didn't do anything in Terrebonne other than add curb and sidewalk, and it brought speeds down by 4 to 5 miles an hour. And that's pretty dramatic decrease in speeds. So, there's a lot of things you can do. Reducing the speed limit tends to reduce the actual operating speeds by less than a mile an hour. So you can see that this is fairly dramatic in terms of, versus just reposting it. So
I drive through there when I come here, and that's very true.
Yes.
It's that narrowing effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even though the roadway cross section is exactly the same, the width of the roadway is the same, it just people perceive it as more constrained and they slow down. So adding vertical elements and creating what we call friction in the sides of the road can be very effective in slowing down traffic. So if you just keep paging, so street trees and sidewalks and again, building heights. This 1-to-2 ratio versus the height of the building to the width of the road, that creates that effect of slowing people down. So there would be a speed like this, a road like this, you're going to want to drive probably 35, 45 miles an hour on this, and posting it 25 isn't going to do a bit of good. And in the same respect, there's no need to post this. This, you know, people are going to drive at appropriate speeds. Anything above 20 miles an hour, you're going to feel reckless, essentially, if you're driving it that fast. Enforcement can target a small percentage, and the only way that I've ever seen to really get dramatic benefits from enforcement is fixed photo enforcement. And the way that Oregon's law is written, you can't do fixed photo enforcement, and there's only 10 cities that are allowed to do photo enforcement statewide, and Lapine isn't one of them. So if you want to go to photo enforcement, you're going to have to go to the legislature first. So how do we establish speed zones? Typically, we do an investigation, and the way the law is written is ODOT is responsible for setting the speed limits basically everywhere in the state. So interstate highways, rural state highways, state highways within city limits, and then county roads and city streets. So if you want to change your speed limit, you ask us, we do the investigation, and then there's an appeal process, and we'll get into that. So what do we do? The road authority makes a written request, comes to us. Dan and his folks go out and do the investigation and make a recommendation. We send it into the state traffic engineer's office, who reviews it and approves it. And then we know, for a city street, we would notify the city and say, here's the investigation, came back. You said you wanted a 35, we think 40 is best. You can either agree or disagree. And then if you disagree, you can appeal it. So what's the investigation take a look at? So we go out there and we get prevailing speeds, look at the number of driveways, look at the road, the curvature of the roadway, and put together this report. It includes maps about what the speed zone of it has. It's got all kinds of photographs. And then we also, we look at crash data. So if there's a high crash rate, that may affect our what we recommend in terms of speed zone. And we also look at prevailing speeds. And I'll get into this a little bit. So basically, we go out and try to radar or laser a number of cars. And we're looking for this, what we call the 85th percentile speed. And it's, this is a typical bell curve, and this is what you see with basically every speed zone investigation. It's more or less the data shaped like this. And so we're looking to set that speed right around the 85th percentile, because that is very, that is slightly higher than most everybody's driving. And it sort of ties this, the speed limit to actual operating speeds. Going back to what I said earlier, that's where it makes sense to drivers. And
Joe, I think that's the area that gets everyone crazy. Yeah. You hear this all the time. You hear it every time you get in this debate. That's crazy. I don't disagree with it all that much, but people say that's crazy. You're saying you go out and if they're all driving 100, then we go put it at 100. You've got to help us walk through more than that graph. Why do you do that? Because people think, well, we're already complaining they're driving 60.
Yeah.
So you're just telling me when you go out in radar and it proves they're driving 60, you're going to set the speed at 60. They can't connect that to add up mentally. They can't get there. People, do you hear that all the time?
It is a challenging one. And so part of it is if they're driving 60 and I set it for 40, if you go back to that slide, then what I risk doing is flattening this curve. And that's more dangerous than this. So because what you want to do is get people in you want to make this as steep as possible, regardless of where it's actually set. Because the more drivers that are driving at similar speeds, the safer the facility is.
What you're saying, too, is the speed limit sign itself isn't going to lower the speed without some of those other measures.
Exactly, yes.
Unless you had a cop full-time sitting there.
Yeah, or photo radar. Yeah.
The speed sign in and of itself, because I think lazy people would say just put it at a lower speed.
Yeah.
And then put a cop out there.
And so, and that does a couple other things. If you have a speed that's just way out of context with the actual road environment, then people don't they sort of perceive, that their perception is, why do I need to follow this? It doesn't make sense. And that can have a spillover effect on your other streets, right? Where, so you want it to sort of, the sign to have a sort of some respect from the driver to say, yeah, it's reasonable for the conditions that I need to drive at. And if it's not intuitive, then you need to figure out a way to impart that information. So like, if I have a lot of pedestrians, so I want a lower speed, then probably I want to have the sidewalks in place. I may want to have some marked crosswalks where they're crossing. I might want to have some signs, you know, where the pedestrians are crossing, so that the driver has an awareness of some other things that are going on, you know. So in and of itself, lowering the speed limit, one, doesn't affect the operating speeds that much, and then begins to not make sense to the driver. And we can, it's kind of a couple of things. If you don't like the way we do investigations, you can say, well, let us do our own, and we will let you do that, but you still have to submit the investigation to the state traffic engineer and sort of follow our process. And since we do the work for free, I've never had a local jurisdiction take me up on that offer. So. And then if you do appeal it, it does go to this thing called the Speed Zone Review Panel, which consists of an ODOT staff person, somebody from Oregon State Police, the Oregon Transportation Safety Commission, actually, a representative from the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties, and they sort of review the work that we did, and then somebody from the local jurisdiction comes in and makes their case why they think it's wrong or how it could be better, and then they make a ruling. And it doesn't happen very often, 4 year statewide, and then the panel's decision is final. So with that, I'll answer any questions.
Just a Pat Creedington came in to tell me what you do here for ODOT. He's one of the bosses there out of Ben.
Thanks, Ron.
Tell him what you do for the ODOT. Titles.
My job is district manager. It includes both operations and maintenance of the highways. And the easiest way to describe that is we take care of almost everything after the highway is built. You know, snow plowing, paving, guardrails, accident cleanup, traffic rerouting. We work closely with Joel because our functions overlap a lot. You know, he's doing traffic engineering, but we have site signing and striping, signals, electrical, all that works together. And so we're maintenance and operations is what we do. We have some influence on the design before it's built, but no more than you guys do.
You need to take care of it after someone else designed.
Yeah, well, that's true.
After Kittleson tells you what to build,
yeah,
you have to live
with it. Well, it's quite a process, and as you go through it, you realize just how complex it can be. It takes years to sort through all the issues. And then we're a small part of that because we see if you build something you can't maintain, you really bought a those bag of worms doing that. We work very closely with Joel's group and Dan's group, and also access is one that people miss, any driveway to the highway. We're the gatekeepers for that. Something has to be controlled because that does have a great influence on accident rates and ability to move traffic back and forth. So,
thanks.
And I'm available for questions. I have some cards here I can hand out afterwards.
I had a question, and that is, I heard what you've said, and this is pretty standard in every state. I've been in 7 states now. But, you know, I was interested when I was in Idaho about this protocol and whether it would hold up over time, and so I decided to do an analysis, a white paper, and work with the BSU to see if just having the state agencies review speeds unto itself would get the kind of results for traffic speeds. And one thing that I found that is real interesting too is that a lot of times the traffic engineers never bother to contact the local sheriff authorities to find out what their segment evaluations are, because you can look at a road and it has certain characteristics, but you talk to a patrol officer that patrols that road over years, and they have all kinds of characteristics and things that they see that they've had to respond to that should be factored into the equation, but never seem to find themselves there. And so as I looked at this analysis between what the state evaluated and saw and what the patrol officers evaluated and saw, I saw marked differences. And then we measured these marked differences and prioritized them. And it was really interesting. But I still don't understand to this day why a state agency would just go out and independently do a speed study without talking to the sheriffs and finding out what their assessments are. Because when a sheriff deputy comes upon an accident and they have to testify in court, they have to have the competencies to do that. So if they have the competencies to be in a court and make a statement, why aren't they a valid person to look to for speed consideration?
You want me to answer that, Bill?
Yeah, go ahead.
So we work closely with our local law enforcement. If it's on a state highway, not only do the orders, but every information that we get gets sent to the state police, okay, but we also work with the state police as well, because they're going to be the ones issuing the tickets, like you're saying, once we do post the speed. If it's within a city or the county, if it's a county road, our request, there's a form that you fill out to get the speed zone review done. There's a request that the city or the jurisdiction has to contact the police and get recommendations from them. So it's the city's responsibility, it's their road. They're the ones responsible to go to their local police enforcement and get that feedback from the police.
All right, and I just wanted to confirm that because we just did. We've just asked ODOT to review Huntington Road. We had that request prompted. I prompted the request, but the request is actually being submitted by our county engineer. And he went to the sheriff captain, who also concurred in the review process. So,
yeah, so there's a little portion in that request that the police should fill out. So
they have.
George Cole.
George has filled it out. The sheriff captain is Niels, maybe that's his name, has filled it out.
So they get to put their input and their reasons for the request as well.
And then I've done my own traffic analysis and said why it needs to be done to detect whether.
We try to do our best in working along with the local enforcement and getting them involved.
All right, well, I appreciate it. I just need to ask, because I didn't see that much in your PowerPoint presentation where law enforcement was a factor.
Well, and we particularly, county request on a county road or a city request on a city street, we work really hard to make sure that if there's a way to reasonably get to the request, we try to get
it. We don't work in a vacuum. we like to get your feedback. We're not here on the local road, so we're just kind of independent, but we try to get your feedback, like where are the issues, what are you trying to do, so then when we get our guys out in the field, we kind of have an understanding of what you're looking at. So we try to work best. Transitioning speeds into the city, things like that, any understanding that we get before we go out there, we try to accommodate what you're trying to do. And we do that all over the whole region, just trying to figure out, if the new school's being built or there's new development where pedestrians are crossing. We might not see that when we're out in the field for just a couple of days, so we want to get as much feedback from the city or local jurisdiction that we can.
Okay, so then what you're saying is you do talk to the sheriff.
Definitely.
And or the police officer and find out what they see as well.
Yep, local contacts, yeah.
It's on your form.
Yeah.
It says local enforcement, and that's line 22, and then the city, and then residents. So you have everybody fill this out.
Yes. Yeah, the local jurisdiction will fill that out, and then we get it. So we have our contacts if we have questions. Usually we work closely with the city or the county, depending on where the request is coming from. We'll contact them if we have any questions when we go out there and try to accommodate what they're asking for. We do have flexibility. It's not just the 85th percentile.
how speeds are set. There's a lot of other things that get looked at. Like Joel said, the pace limit is one of the most important things. That's the 10-mile-an-hour group that everybody's based on. The more people you get driving in that 10-mile-an-hour group, the better the highway is going to function or the roadway is going to function. That's really one of the most critical things that we look at. Crash rates as well, how many pedestrians there are crossing. We try to document as much information as we can. So when we're proposing it, we have enough backing for getting the recommendation approved. So we work with the city as well. If we're not meeting your request, we're not just going to submit it to Salem. We like to try to work with the local jurisdiction, say, here's what we've found, you know, here's what we're thinking, you know, here's where we can go, and try to work it out with them. So we're not just, you know, making our own recommendations as well. We're trying to get as much input as we can when we're putting together a report. We want it to get approved. There's always steps. You know, you might go out on the road and people are driving fast, but the city might have something planned to put in, you know, some signs or sidewalks, so we can go out, lower the speed a little bit 1 year, and we can go back out and investigate it next year. You know, it's not just once and done. We can go back out as many times as needed before, you know, crashes are reduced or people feel safer.
Okay. Yeah, I would like to segue into that just a little bit about working with the police and the sheriff. This Tim McGinnis,
he was our program last month.
Mm-hmm. He's Tim and his cohorts and the maintenance crews work very closely with the state police. They spend hours and hours and hours together on crashes and other meetings and stuff, but they get to know each other very well, and we do respect and listen to what they have to say, and they respect and listen to what we have to say, because we do work. Well, we used to be one agency, but they split that off some years ago. But I think you'll find that they work very well together.
Any questions or comments from, I think the idea of this was to, maybe when we get into some other things, what Joel will show and all these guys help work on is how we slow down traffic. I think, you know, I'm convinced that it's really, The speed sign is one, but I think you have to realize that's just one tool, and it may be the least effective, but it's the one we all jump to. But I, over years, I've come to that conclusion. So it's things like the trees and the things. And so, you know, we've got this big wide open highway out here. It's just screaming to drive fast because we don't have any of these things. And so, unless you disagree totally with what, you know, if you buy into the fact that you just go throw a 20-mile-an-hour sign on it, people will drive it. But I think that hopefully we can get to where we do some of this stuff so it has a double impact of slowing traffic and making Lapine look better, the more people stop and shop, play, and want to live here. So, I guess you convinced them of...
Rick, and that's where the corridor plan that Joe's talked to you folks about quite extensively, mm-hmm. has that incorporated into it. And that's going to be a big deal. It's not just scenic and beautiful. It has those design criteria that Joel's talking about incorporated into it.
And on that note, I guess one of the questions might be a real good segue into the corridor plan topic is, Joel or Dan, I don't know which would be more appropriate, but two other pieces to the speeds. One is school zones and how those are set and what schools are applicable and what are those requirements. And the second one is the transition. As you go from the place that you said this has to be 55 to the place that this has to be 20, mm-hmm. how is that transition designated? And I think that it helps address a lot of the discussion from our last meeting.
Yeah, well, I guess typically we want to put school zones around the schools, safe route of the school plan. And the way the federal program, the federal safe routes to school program, it says that only elementary and middle schools or junior highs are eligible for safe routes to school funding, but we can develop a safe route to school and the thought process is that younger kids are they're physically and mentally less able to judge things like an appropriate gap to cross or the speed of an oncoming car. The high schooler's sense of judgment is more developed. They may not use that sense of judgment, but theoretically they have it. So that at the federal level, the program is targeted to elementary and middle school. But any school that has kids walking or biking to it is eligible, you know, is, can we can put it in a, you know, a school zone for the school itself or a specific crossing, as long as that crossing is on a safe route to school, identified safe route to school plan. Where the rub is developing a safe route to school plan is kind of a lot of work for the school, and typically the places that are successful at developing those plans have a lot of resources from volunteers. Sisters is a good example of that. It has a very aggressive safe route to school plan, and they have some very involved parents who volunteer.
Can you nail that to me, because your ears is not coming up even in here.
Do you have internet?
You can come up. Yeah.
All right.
I can get to that.
So, Joel, you've received the study, and what is the timeline on completing the request for the study on the Huntington Road?
Oh, Huntington?
I don't think we've received it yet. So is it submitted to Salem?
4:30.
Yeah, so probably went to Salem.
Okay.
So we'll get our part of it done this summer, and then send it in, and then they're usually a month or two behind, but it would be probably by fall.
Yeah, we usually say it's about a year process from when we get the request to when we finish, only because we use a lot of summer help. So by getting the request this spring or right now, we're kind of putting it in the mix for this summer. So, you know, if we get to it this summer and get all the work done this summer, there's a process where you guys have an approval timeline as well. So, you know, if we get the investigation complete this summer, it might be a month or two before you get the final approval, and then whatever timeline you might have to get your signs installed. So you can see changes this fall. You know, kind of, it's a lengthy process, but.
Do you ever consideration safe routes for seniors? The reason I bring that up is we have a senior center over here, and we're building a bunch of senior housing next to it. It's on Huntington Road. Those seniors have certain predictable pathways,
yes.
And they have, as we know, seniors have slower response times. And so is there ever any considerations? I see you've got it for children. What about seniors?
Well, I don't know, there's not a formal program, but like, for instance, in Bend, we manage the city of Bend's traffic signals, mm-hmm. and on 27th Street, there's some senior housing on the east side of the highway, mm-hmm. And then, of course, Safeway is on the west side of the highway, and so there's a lot of people that go back and forth because the pharmacy is at Safeway, and so at the signal right there, we installed buttons. If you hold the buttons in longer, you get a longer walk. And then we just, you know, we got complaints from the, you know, from seniors that they weren't getting enough crossing time across 27. So we installed those buttons and just, you know, went there. You know, senior housing, I think they wanted lunch or something, and Splade said, if you hold the button in for 3 seconds, you'll get a longer walk. I mean, so there's things that we can do, and certainly you can look at more aggressive crossing treatments to help people cross at an uncontrolled location. And then, you know, and other things, if you have a signal, look at protected lefts where you have your own arrow versus a permissive left, because that's a thing that's difficult for older drivers to judge is the speed of oncoming traffic. So, you know, those are kind of, you know, sort of a, where you have some judgment as an engineer, you might go to a higher level of protection group, something like that. So,
did you put this together, Steve, the last page?
Yeah.
I like that. Because he's solving two things at one time, the senior crossing and the kid zone. That all be done. Good job, Steve. So when you're all reviewing this, good job.
Joel?
Yeah.
When did this holding the button in, and how do people know holding the button in longer gives them a longer cross? This is the first I've heard about.
Well, we don't do it everywhere.
I understand that, but if I go to that crossing, is there a sign telling me that?
No, we went and we just went and talked to the people at the senior housing and let them know that was there. So,
That's interesting, because
I didn't know that.
Yeah, we don't have it everywhere. You know, there's also other things you can do with, you know, we're getting more, you know, we're getting more of the countdown pedestrian heads out where, you know, once it goes from the walk to the flash and go walk, it tells you how many seconds are left and counts
it down. I've seen that. But that's a visual thing. But if I was in that area and I just moved there, I wouldn't know to hold the button in longer to get a longer crosswalk signal. And so you need to educate or figure out a way to educate the seniors better because they have an ever-changing population.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so I, you know, we met with the, you know, we met with this, you know, the staff at the same time. We met with the, you know, with the folks there. And so hopefully that, you know, they're able to communicate that. And, you know, it's one of those things that it's a challenge. I mean, you know, it's one signal out of 100-something that we own. And manage, so you know, it's not like we can be there every week updating them at lunch about.
Marlo, you'd get across.
I'm a senior citizen.
But you'd get across.
And so,
you know, I mean, that's good to know.
Yeah. And so, you know, another thing that's been done at sort of a national level is we changed the walk, the length of the walk and flashing don't walk we reduced the assumed walking speed because of the aging population.
Right.
So we said basically you walk at a half a foot per second slower than we had previously assumed, and we're going to adjust all our walk times. So the baseline is acknowledging that sort of aging population.
That's why some of us already, when we see it says don't walk, we walk. Because it's got a lot of time left.
Yeah.
If you're fast.
Not only that, I'm in the baby boomer generation. And they're becoming senior citizens by an alarming rate.
Yeah. Yeah. I take objection to that.
Okay.
We'll never get old.
Okay. any other comments on ODOT's, the proposal of ODOT and what they proposed before we move on to Kittleson Associates? All right, let's go ahead and proceed.
All right, my name is Joe Besman. I'm with Kittleson and Associates. I was the consultant that helped to lead the 97 corridor plan. But as I look around this room, there's a lot of people that were also really involved from ODOT, from the county. Kitty was the mayor and was helping to get the project off the ground. Rick was certainly at every meeting and helping to steer this. And so if I state anything wrong, feel free to jump in and help me out here. But generally, it was the corridor project was looking at involving all the agencies that had some type of responsibilities for Highway 97, and really that was between 1st Street and 6th Street, so really down here in the downtown core. The project need was really stemming from some different videos that were taken by city staff. Luana Dummerho had taken some videos, and basically kids were running across the street, and they were running right in front of trucks. They were there was other kids, if you go to the next slide. A couple of girls that were there that, you know, they sat there for about 2 minutes, you know, doing one of these numbers, and what we found was that there's no driver willing to yield to a pedestrian here. You know, you're going 55, 45, 35, and the car behind you might still be going 55, and you know you're afraid to stop. You know, you don't want it because you don't know if the guy behind you is going to stop as well. There was a lot of other issues. If you look at where those girls are actually crossing on the road, you know, it's not at the And if it was at the corner, it still isn't that great because how these roads align. But what we saw was the kids were going from McDonald's, taking a straight line path right across the parking lot, jumping over this wooden split rail fence, not even using the sidewalk path that was out here. And so there was just a lot of issues all at once that we were looking at, you know, trying to solve. But as we looked at that, we realized it wasn't just this one location, it was really the corridor as a whole. So, vehicular safety. You know, we were concerned with the vehicles that were trying to get onto the highway, trying to get off of the highway. You know, how can we make that safer? Capacity. When the city was considering different applications to build new uses in the Liggy Industrial Park areas, those were being told, well, you know, you can't build because if you do that, you're going to have to improve the highway. Right now, the highway isn't adequate to allow those uses. Speed transition. Again, We've got a 35 mile an hour sign on the highway as you're heading southbound into Lapine. But you know, just north of that, we have a 45 mile an hour sign. Just north of that, it's 55, and just north of that, it's a passing lane. So how are we getting that speed of transition? That goes right back to what Joel and Dan had spoken about. Economic development, again, the Liggy Lands, the barrier at Lapine. You know, it's really the east and west. How do you get people across the street, not just at First Street, but really anywhere? And then balancing that community vision with the highway purpose. How does the city integrate Highway 97? How does it build into the city's goals and the city's vision for how it wants to grow, while still maintaining those mobility, expressway, statewide highway functions that we know the highway has to do for economic reasons? We looked at a lot of the surrounding land uses. The challenge was, you know, here's Highway 97, here's First Street, you got the senior center over here, you got a fire station, you got retail uses, you got all the schools. You have all these different land uses, which basically are saying, you know, you're going to need to cross the highway. At First Street and Reed Road, what we've done is kind of highlighted the existing striping. And as you're coming southbound, you get this taper where, you know, if you've got a small car, it might be enough to get out of the way of cars behind you. But if you're in a truck, and by the way, this is all the industrial land, so this is kind of where we want our trucks to go. If you're in a truck, you can't quite fit in here and still get people around you very easily. You've got this 15-foot offset. These intersections don't go straight across. So if this guy wants to turn left and this guy wants to turn left, you've got to figure out who's going to go first, because you can't go at the same time. Your paths would cross. Here you've got a right turn lane, and it's a massive right turn lane, you know, real wide. It's about 20 feet wide or so. But it doesn't get a whole lot of use. And what that does, though, is it makes those people that are crossing the street go 20 feet further, and that's, you know, an area of exposure for them. So this is the view. This looks like it's facing southbound as you're coming into town. And what I wanted to show here is, when you're just north of First Street, you really don't know there's a whole lot changing. And this goes right back to what Joel was saying. You don't see that change.
Right.
You still see rural highway. Yep. There's the trees that are kind of blocking your view. So even though you see the 45 mile an hour sign, you don't have a reason to change your speed choice. As you get closer in, you know, one of the things we noticed is it gets real busy all of a sudden. You get signs and messages, you know, being blasted at you from the left and the right, guide signs, parking signs, bus stop signs, commercial signs. There's just a lot going on right in this area. So now drivers are being put in this position here where they're trying to figure out how to make a decision. They're, you know, looking for the cars that are sitting here trying to turn. They're trying to avoid those guys. And the last thing you expect is for a kid to be walking across the street. You know, and that's just one more decision you're trying to make as you're getting here. So in the northbound direction, what's happening is you've got passing lanes in Lapine, and there was a lot of concern about how this was creating a speed differential. Most of the trucks stay in the left lane. They don't even get over in the right lane. Mm-hmm. The right lane essentially becomes the business access. You know, if you're going to decelerate, turn into a commercial establishment, you'll get in that right lane. But where that outside lane ends, the curb doesn't change. The curb still stays, you know, to allow a whole five-lane roadway going through town. But you have this stripe, and that leads to other problems, whether it's trucks parking in that space or just the additional crossing area. And then we have the sidewalk system. You know, as we were sitting out here doing our field visit, you know, there was a gal pushing a stroller through here, and you know, doing one of these numbers, and you know, it gets difficult. And I'm not trying to highlight the maintenance facility, because this is really the case on the the west side of the highway, on a lot of portions of the highway. But as you go to the next one, you know, in Lapine, higher elevation, you get more snow, and you know, this snow might last weeks at a time, and you know, during that time too, it's relatively impassable. So how do we work on getting the infrastructure, getting the maintenance, getting the design that'll accommodate this and allow for, you know, when they plow the highways, you know, somewhere to store the snow outside of the sidewalks? So what we did, and you know, this picture shows a lot of the people in this room right here, we took the whole group and we actually walked this corridor, walked from the north end to the south end and back up on the other side of the street, and took a lot of photos, took a lot of notes and observations, and really had a lot of great suggestions from the county, from ODOT, from the city about, you know, different issues as you go along the corridor. And that really informed a lot of our assessment. Crashes. Yeah, we looked at the crash data. The truth is, Lapine doesn't have a real high number of crashes on the highway. I think there's a lot of concern as you're turning left, and because of that concern and that hesitation, people usually make pretty good decisions. Now, I say that, but as I watched the videotapes from when they took the traffic counts, there's a lot of near misses. You know, there's a lot of really erratic, illegal maneuvers going on the highway, and the potential there is high, don't get me wrong. But the actual crashes are relatively low. Vast majority of crashes, as you see everywhere around the state, it's dry, sunny, clear conditions. You know, there's a good portion of ice and snow-related crashes, 19% of the total, which is much higher than most areas. I think Bend is around 5% or so. But generally, yeah, clear's got clear days. Key findings, just going through and looking at the city, I think we've already talked about a lot of these. Just not really a good design through town, not really a clear path for people to go through, no clear designation for drivers, pedestrians, bicyclists, really anybody. So one of the things we looked at is, how do we build a system of pedestrian crossings in this whole corridor? What we identified were these locations, and I know you probably can't see the labels, but...
Are those on their maps?
No.
I don't think I have this handout in here. I will, by the way, give you the link to this PowerPoint presentation.
Good, because I'd like some of that data that you just went through.
The final report has all kinds of additional technical details. But basically, we said, you know, if we can provide a crossing at first, over by the Ray's food place, we get the apartments on the east side, the grocery on the west. Mm-hmm. You know, reconsider this school speed zone. You know, is that really the right place for a school crossing? Does it need to be expanded? Does it need to be moved? Does it need to be relocated? You know, where should the school crossing go? And I say that because while we were out there on our field observations, you know, we timed it during the early Wednesday school dismissal period. We didn't see pedestrians crossing there. We saw them crossing north of there, south of there, around there, but not there. So look at the Ray's Food Place, 4th Street. Was another crossing, and I think that's actually in your handouts how that can be designed. Pentington Road, that was an identified crossing, and at the time the vision was, how do you make Huntington Road part of that downtown corridor? Well, and if you can connect that with a pedestrian crossing at Huntington and one at 4th, you know, you can really get that multimodal system to work better there. Mm-hmm. Over at Morrison and Finley Butte, and we'll get into details on that intersection too, and then over at 6th Street, and that gives you a whole system of pedestrian treatments to really bridge the east and west side of the city. The cross section of 97.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
You know, we focused a lot of energy on First and Reed, and we're saying that's probably a 2 or 3 year process to make that happen. And it's a $1.4 million ticket too, and it requires a lot of right-of-way acquisition. And it's a slow, precarious process. But I note that you've highlighted 3 or 4 other pedestrian crossings. Could those just be installed now before that? And is there a big ticket cost with putting those in place now?
There's a few of those that could be put in, but almost all of these are standalone projects. I think in your packet, if you go to, I think, the 4th page, it shows a concept for 4th Street, if I'm not mistaken. And the idea of that one is, if you have a 3-lane cross-section, put in some type of median. And that was a big discussion of the freight industry about that median design and dimensions and everything else. But if you could provide some type of refuge in the center, and then, you know, whether initially or later on, you can even put in those rapid rectangular flashing beacons, which are what you see on the parkway in Bend now with the push buttons, but a pedestrian activated indication, not just a light that flashes all the time and tells you that someday there might be a pedestrian here, but when this is flashing, there is a pedestrian here, and be prepared to yield. That was one of the concepts we looked at, and I think had general loadout support on that concept.
Yeah, and those are solar powered too, by the way.
Can be. Or they can be hardwired.
Yeah.
I think what we want to do first is figure out how to implement the 3-lane cross section as sort of the first step, because just that reducing the cross sectional width is what is. You know, you shorten that crossing up by 30-40% essentially. So that makes it safer just by doing that. and hopefully lower the speed, and then we can look at more aggressive kind of crossing.
Do we have a time for when we could do that?
We can hopefully give you up to speed.
Okay. So we could do it by tomorrow, right?
Maybe not tomorrow, but
as well as, you know, like we're saying, is a lot of pedestrians are crossing randomly. And if we want to make improvements, what we want to try to do is corral them as best we can so they're using that facility. If we go and put a $50,000 flashing beacon, we want to make sure people are using it. And the ones that we install in Bend, what we see is a lot of the kids and a lot of the people don't use them. They just walk by them. So you really want to make sure when we put those in that there's a facility there that people are going to use, and they're going to walk maybe a little bit out of direction and get there and use those and get a safer crossing.
Well, some of these, like Finley Butte and William Foss, are going to take a lot of those school kids, because that's where all the subdivisions are, and a lot of the housing for the school-aged children is over that way. Most of it is, if they're not riding a bus.
You know, but as I hear what you're saying, there's sort of like a dares goes first. You know, we want to do something, but we want to make sure that whatever we do, we substantiate. And so until we do that, we won't do anything. And I guess I'm just of the belief that you do something, right or wrong, is better than not doing anything at all, ever.
Yeah, and I think we're there. We want to make incremental investments and target them to the right spot. So I think, you know, systematically you look at the narrower cross section, that helps. And then, you know, sidewalk infill and stuff, and getting data on where people are actually, you know, getting really good data on where people are actually crossing. So you're prioritizing the busiest crossings first, or the least safe.
Are there incentives to get people to cross where you want them to cross? Other than, you know, I'm crossing the street because there's a McDonald's over there. I mean, is there a way to modify behaviors to get people to align? Like, for instance, I hear a hesitation because kids will cross any place along this. It's sort of like a corridor rather than a pedestrian crosswalk location. Are there things you can do to modify behaviors to direct people to go to a certain location and cross?
We can help encourage. And part of this cross-section treatment is kind of like the deer fences you see along 97.
That's kind of what I was thinking, exactly.
We have the swale, and it's not a moat yet. You know, we're not going to fill that with water, but you know, depending on how you design some of these treatments, you know, people don't want to get their shoes muddy, you know, especially certain times of year. And so you can help design the landscaping around that. You can design, you know, what that swale looks like, and really encourage them to use the crossings that we designate.
So that would be moatscaping.
Moatscaping, yes. But deer fencing.
It's one of those things that it requires, like, you know, the 3 or 4E concept of the education, enforcement, and engineering. So you engineer the facility so you can cross there. You use the schools to educate, you know, people, you know, the kids on where to cross, but it's a lot, you know. But then it becomes a lot of work. I mean, you have to have somebody that's going to, you know, that's going to sort of push that within the school system and do the outreach and
Joel's dealt with this a lot in Parkway, and we have two as maintenance. The conclusion is that people won't go the shortest distance they can. And we talked about this with, you know, when we were designing the Parkway, overcrossings, undercrossings. There was a theory that if it's, you know, people don't use them, well, they don't use them because it's a lot easier to walk straight across. But if you've got a fence or a wall where they can't walk straight across, they'll use it. I mean, it's pretty simple. It's all... You can force it. You have to apply a little bit of force. These kids you see coming out of McDonald's, well, you can see that it's a line of sight to the far corner that doesn't match with the other corner because these intersections are askew. You've got a sidewalk that leads out to the middle of the block. That's not a good idea. You've got a fence that makes a nice challenge for somebody on the track team, you know, to hurdle over. It's pretty obvious. People want to go line of sight. We hear it with accesses to the highway. You know, every merchant wants, as soon as they see my store, I'll drive straight into it. Driveways, it's the same, pretty much the same with all human nature. We had an instance where we had housing on one side of the parkway and we had the stores on the other side of the parkway. Then we had a lot of people walking across, jumping a wall that was about 5 feet high on the other side. This is a four-lane facility with cars doing probably averaging 50 miles an hour. Mothers with strollers, kid in tow. You know, there's a sidewalk, there's a bridge, 50 feet from where they're crossing. But they had to walk a block down and then a block to get back up over the top of it. So what we did is, we had two 14-year-old kids hit there. Neither one of them got killed, but they were pretty badly injured. Got a grant, put a sidewalk up that bank to the bridge, just as close as we could to the crossing, and then fenced it off so it made it very difficult to cross. You still get people crossing. You know, some people have to prove that they can still do it. But usually these are the guys in their 20s, right, the cowboys. They got to build a curb, they got to drive over to four-wheel drive. You build a fence, they got to jump it. They only do it so much until it becomes inconvenient. And we see a lot of use now of that other one, but you have to make it inconvenient. You have to give them an attractive alternative. You know, people aren't going to go out of their way if they can possibly go straight.
So go to Las Vegas and go to all those busy corners, and you are forced over that dumb thing. And it's because about 30 yards back, they have a nice brick wall with wrought iron fences in it. Once you get toward that corner, you are like a zoo animal. You cannot, and you have to go up those steps and go over, because I guarantee otherwise. You know, and that came up out at Wicked Junction out there for the railroad tracks. What do you do with kids that want to cross out there? Since the road's going to go up over the top, you can build this big fancy thing. The railroad track is for me to you, width. You think I'm going to go up, and you have to make it ADA. Yeah. So I'm going to go through some windy deal to cross over something and do all of that? Hell no. For 10 trains a day, I'm jetting across. So it's.
Yeah. I found in my previous park experience that when you deal with youth, a lot of times it helps to go to their facility, ask them what they would like, not guaranteeing that's going to happen, but see what they would like, and then try and incorporate a compromise in that facility. And I would encourage ODOT and anybody else, when you start dealing with the youth of this community, to do the same thing. I mean, we built a skate park thinking I knew what I wanted for a skate park for them, and it was totally different when you talk to the kids. So I would encourage that.
Yeah. And Steve Hassett has made that point real clear with the city planning work, you know, making a real effort to go out to the schools, recognizing they don't yet have a Safe Routes to School plan, but how do we get their buy-in? How do we make it their idea?
Mm-hmm. That's the key.
Yeah.
Did you use this slide yet?
So real quick on the cross-section, and I think Joel's exactly right. The cross-section is probably the biggest impediment because you've got speed differentials, you've got poor definition of where things are, and you have a lack of sidewalks on the west side of the highway. So the cross-section is in your packet where you can see it a lot better. But generally, it's taking the entire highway and making it a three-lane section. Now, we don't need the five-lane section for capacity reasons. I mean, let's face it, the highway next right back down to two lanes north of town. Mm-hmm. So what is five lanes really buy you? But with that, you know, I think it'll help with the culture of the speed. It'll help enforce that 35 mile an hour posted speed through town. It provides us an opportunity for a swale which can be used for snow storage or just runoff treatment. Gives us the space for the bicycle lanes, even a little bit of a buffer between those bicycles and the cars and trucks. So let's face it, there's a lot of trucks on this highway. The other benefit is for the over-dimensional freight, gives them a little bit more clearance space as well. And that's really what we're looking at, a pretty wide sidewalk with illumination too. And that illumination being provided, you know, over time, initially at the intersections where it's needed the most, at the transition areas, the north and south into town, where we want people to see a difference from that rural to urban area. But then ultimately,
you know, you're actually lucky you have this much width. It's what's causing your problem now. But often, other communities have a few feet too many, but it's harder to do all of this. If you look at that, this guy in the 8-foot sidewalk over here, do you know what I mean? He's 15 feet from that semi. So when roads splashing water, when the snow plows come by, they're way over. And you've got the width, you have 13 feet for a swale. You could have it landscaped, it's going to take that snow and water, plus you got a bike lane, plus you even have a 3-foot buffer. so I mean, you are lucky. It's what's causing your trouble now. But when you fix this, you can have a pretty nice looking city coming through this town pretty easy.
And everyone's going to be slowed down to 35, one lane each way.
Yeah. I mean, they will. I mean, it's going to, you don't.
I have your word on it.
Yeah, that's right. Do you have a complete layout from one side of the city to the other?
We looked at that and we took it out of the plan because there are some specific access issues and some parking issues by the, I forget the name of it, but the market, the Shell station that are right next to each other. And what we heard from ODOT is let's not be overly specific because that'll hinder the ability to negotiate with those business owners that are in the right of way. I mean, there is a 100-foot right of way throughout this entire corridor. ODOT owns the property, but we wanted to be somewhat sensitive to those issues and give them that flexibility. And part of it too is we have some flexibility. That swale doesn't have to hold that same dimension throughout. Now we want to keep those travel lanes as straight as we can, of course. But we have some flexibility in changing some of those dimensions to accommodate various uses. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is where our team ultimately came to with First Street and Reed Road. And this is a big improvement. You know, this is over $1 million, and as time goes on, that cost will probably continue to go on as well. But the idea was, we know we have a skew between these two things not coming together at a perfect 90 degree angle, which is going to make it difficult for the trucks. With this being the truck area, having this right turn that's kind of pulled out with a gentler radius allows us to get these trucks back in the right direction. Having this somewhat odd striping in the middle of the intersection helps us to avoid this skew and the alignment issues and still minimize that needed right-of-way, so we're not taking over the Taco Bell and McDonald's. Because the other option is you could sweep these way down, and it's much more expensive, much more impactive. And given what the volumes are out here, we felt that this was the best trade-off between those different issues. You can see here too, this is actually a traffic signal. So you've got your signal poles here, your indications, traffic stops all four directions with the light. That gives us the opportunity to put in these crosswalks. You can see we've tried to come across this one a little ways to really get people to where they're trying to go, thinking that maybe that'll help encourage the use of that crosswalk. And what this one doesn't show you as much is all the additional treatments that are upstream. I mean, there is the left turn lane that you see. There is additional widening to get the alignment for that northbound vehicle to continue straight through. But there's a lot of other things between this colored pavement treatment or whatever it is there to help people slow down. Because again, we don't want them going 55 miles an hour and coming to a traffic signal on an icy road and sliding through it and still hitting that pedestrian that has the walk indication. You know, so with this design, there's a lot of treatments to try and make sure we're meeting people's expectations. Any questions on that?
Did you consider a lane coming off Reed Road that would let you merge onto the, I mean, you got a radius corner, but if you created a 100-200 foot merge lane.
You need an acceleration lane for your heavy trucks.
Yeah.
And that was just it. If we put in that acceleration lane, we have to design it for trucks, and that cost is incrementally higher, and you know, it was...
Are you talking when they come out and head right, that way?
Get north
right.
Down.
Give them.
Right.
That, I'll jump in on that. The distance of those is typically, you know, for these speeds, because you'd be wanting them to accelerate to 45 and 55 by the end of it, is closer to 1,000 feet. And we're building one in Redmond on the new alignment of 97 up there. So it comes out around 1,000 feet of acceleration length plus the taper. So you're talking about an extra $300,000 or so. The other thing is people at a signal, they're typically not expecting the ability to merge rather than yield and then go. And I don't know, if you're familiar with I-5 at Broadway in Northeast Portland by the Rose Garden, we have one of these. We have a ton of rear end accidents, and what happens is people that know the area know that they can pull on. People that don't assume that they have to stop and yield like 98% of every right turn you make. and they end up getting rear-ended. So there's a real, there's some real trade-offs that we want to think about in terms of cost and safety. And I've done the same thing at, there's one of these that, those that, where you turn on the 22 in Salem from, where is that, by the old Kmart.
Market,
yeah. And I always stop, and then, I get to go.
And also, you're in a 25-mile-an-hour zone. I don't know if you want to celebrate.
He's talking about going north.
All right, no, there's still a 25-mile-an-hour zone going to 35.
It's 35.
This is 35 going to 45. 45 is posted right around here.
And then it immediately transitions.
The truck volume is still pretty low coming off so of far, first. Yeah. If you think about it, I mean, you know, 90% of the time there wouldn't be a truck in you there.
No way that they could slow the traffic down.
Well, keep in mind there's a light here, so that truck actually has a green light. So, and he's really not conflicting with anyone other than maybe a left turn that's coming off of here, depending on what type of treatment. So
the only time it's a conflict is when it's essentially right on red.
Right.
So, and it's something that if you had a huge increase in truck volumes later.
So he's going to have just a yield.
Yeah.
So basically he should have some speed. You're coming off red. Maybe.
Any other questions on this one? All right. So this one probably is something you can see better in your packets. But this is identifying all the transition treatments to help get the speeds down to that 35-mile-an-hour consistent speed before they get to First Street. So you can see there's a lot of different things. You know, simple things the city can do, from having more Lapine monument signs just up ahead, having the speed radar signs, and that's another conversation for Joel to jump back in here after I finish talking about this one. Raised pavement markers, which are designed carefully here for the snow plows, so they don't all get wiped out. But basically, what can you do to change what the driver sees up here to what they see down here? So that's all spelled out. It's a lot more detail within your within the actual.
Does that include any taking the trees back on the north end of your city there, top end?
I didn't put it in there, but driving through there, it probably should.
I think that would be a great idea because from that passing lane to there, you're funneled into trees that come out near the highway. And if you would open that up like you did just down south of Highway 31 and all, that would make a big difference.
Right, because I noticed one of your earlier photos, that approach, you've got several trees. You cannot see the buildings, but if you can see the buildings, all of a sudden it's not a surprise when you get there.
Absolutely.
And depending on who owns the property, we could do that. No, that's easy.
You got a 400-foot right-of-way just north of town.
The city owns the property.
It's government, pretty much government. There's not much private. So between
we may be knocking on your door asking for permission to cut
the county, us, or the feds. Or,
well, Tim's going to have to get a logging permit.
I think his permit starts with a pull cord.
Did you want to talk about that?
All right. So there's a lot of details in here. Just different options.
Great.
Philly viewed Morrison, well, we know Morrison doesn't work well with this angle that it comes into the highway with. You see both the super fast left turn coming up northbound that kind of sneaks through, then you see the people making the left turn from Morrison onto the highway that, you know, just sometimes can't quite make it around.
That's John's A-frame where the road's going through the middle.
Yeah.
That says real A-frame with the realtor banner on it. Right here.
That's right. So the idea is, how can you improve this intersection here? You know, if you've got a signal at the north end, signal at the south end, it gives you a lot of gaps in traffic to make other movements, you know, from the businesses, from the side streets, all throughout town. But then, really, to maximize that benefit, bringing Morrison over, aligning this into one location, I mean, now you've got a whole package system with Morrison Street, where, you know, if you are somewhere in here, you don't have to make that unsignalized left turn from a stop sign. Now you can go back to Morrison, you got the traffic signal, you can get onto the highway, you got the pedestrian crossing benefits. I mean, a lot of benefits of having this type of system. And it goes beyond just improving the highway, but really to improving the city network as well.
That's your end.
And so what I did was, this presentation and the overall corridor plan, which goes into a lot more detail, has a lot more discussion. If you go to this site, and I can email this to you, Steve, and you, Rick, and you
guys can hand it out. Steve has a lot to write.
But Those documents are posted online as a publicly accessible website, so anyone can go and see those.
What we should do is put a link on our website, because you know, we're going to end up with the TSP. We don't need the public running around having to figure out, I need a website for the TSP, I need a website for the corridor plan. We should simplify somehow on our website where they can click on these, and I think that would increase. I never use this because whenever I want it, I can't remember it, wherever I am.
Right.
So it's got to be basic for me.
So any other questions? I know I'm taking up a lot of time, so.
No, you're doing fine.
Great.
So what's the timeline? What's the funding? You mean, or are you not going to talk about that? You give them just a general.
Yeah, so we have a project in STIP, our capital improvement program. Essentially, you know, so price tag on the signal that, and so the only thing that's really funded is First and Reed. It's not fully funded, so we have not enough money to do what we want.
Email address.
So we either got to figure out how to get more money, or we got to figure out how to do something good with the money we have. And so that's kind of the.
There it is.
That's kind of where we are now. We just kicked off the project development process.
They're looking at developing what we could construct with the money we have, and also developing the long term.
What's a reasonable timeline? Based on that, you've got X amount, you know, I mean, you got a good share of the money, but I mean, is it something you would see that would happen next summer?
No, because we're going to have to acquire right away. So you're talking, you know, as soon as we get the footprint settled, which hopefully will be like sometime in the winter, you know, then we can move into the right away process, which it essentially takes a year to acquire right away. There's federal timelines, and you know, sometimes they can go faster, but if the person you're trying to buy from takes all the available time, you're talking about a year from the time you identify the right away, write the description, and make the offer. So
are we looking like 3 years?
Something like that, yeah. But we do have some ideas on what we would like to do this summer. We can, that hopefully we'd really be focusing on just reducing the speeds for southbound approaching traffic. So I mean, that's really where we see the most critical area, because of the, you know, reducing the speed so that the kids crossing, you know, that there's reduces the, you know, the likelihood of a crash and or the severity of a crash if it occurs. So that we've got some ideas on that. We'd like to share that with Steve before we start rolling out.
So is there anything that we can do with the city to help the process?
If we've got $1 million laying around, I think we can just, you know, like any, you know, I think we'll have to have some discussions about, you know, if we want to implement the signal and go that direction, we'll have to look at what are our options for funding that and where that money's coming from. And I think that's, you know, that's when the rubber sort of meets the road.
Is there any desire or ability of the businesses in Lapine to kind of come together and help with any type of matching funds? Do you think they'd be supportive of that?
Is there any truth to the northeast corner of 1st and 97 that Safeway owns that?
I don't know.
That's what I'd heard for 5-6 years, that Safeway owns it, and they're waiting for that to be realigned before they did anything in this town.
Which corner?
Northeast corner, 1st and 97, across from McDonald's.
That belongs to
Reed Road in 97.
I'm sorry, Reed Road.
Across the street.
Reed Road in 97.
The Shell Station.
No, it's not Reed. It's right across from McDonald's. Yeah.
It's candy corner from the ODOT shop.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's Reed Road through there.
Yeah. Okay.
First Street's on the other side.
Okay.
That belongs to a gentleman that owns some property over off Huntington, too. I just was checking on ownership, so it's still in local ownership as we speak. I don't know anything about a safe.
That's not part of the business park or anything else. That's somebody's private.
It's their own personal property. Yes, that is a piece there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well,
so
that
would
help if we could just
there,
right? Shave that off.
So it's right away acquisition.
Private property behind the BLM property.
Let me jump in with just two things right now, because this needs all of our help. One of the things that the city did was just approve its budget last evening, and part of the budget process was goals. And we came up with 17 goals and put some money with them. And one of the goals is to come up with a template for how we can have some kind of a corridor presentation along 97 through the community. And we thought as part of that presentation process that we would start with our own property here. We have 450 feet out front. We'd like to redesign it this year. We'd like to put in stormwater management, drainage, sidewalks, illumination, landscaping, whatever. And if left to our own devices, we can and will do that. But the question is, in doing that, are we doing something that will have to be undone later, or something that doesn't meet the mark of what needs to be done in the entire looking at what needs to be done on 97? So I would encourage ODOT to work with the city. I would encourage the Public Works to work with the city so that we're all evaluating what it is that we're doing out here that will serve as a template that we can look to for all the other businesses as they develop and redevelop to do out here. Okay? So I need your help.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we've got the, you know, the cross-section that we developed, the corridor plan sets those, you know, sets those dimensions, and we can start to work off those dimensions.
Now, we'd rather use your dimension that's already been done than come up with and articulate our own vision and our own version. Okay. The other thing is, I just want to invite everybody here. There is a state team, and each region has one. It's called the Solutions Team. And that Solutions Team is made up of different state agencies. And they're all going to come down here and visit with us on June 7th. They're going to be here from like 10 to 2 or 3. And they're going to ask us as a community what our needs are and how they can help facilitate them. Well, ODOT will be one of the principal players in all of that. So I just want to invite you folks to be thinking about what it is that the state could help us with. That when we meet with the Solutions Team on June 7th, that they're poised to be able to help us because we've anticipated what our needs are and how they might help us. Okay?
Okay. You mentioned working with ODOT. You know, the lady that you hired from was Little River Landscaping or whatever.
Uh-huh.
She did call earlier in the week, and we're working with her on the needs. Here, there are a couple issues. Come up any time a town starts to redevelop like this is we had money years ago, the county did, to do sidewalks through town, but they didn't address drainage. And anytime you put a curb or sidewalk in, you change the drainage, you've got to deal with the water. So that has to be part of the overall plan. I don't know if you did that in your part yet, or does that come later with the engineering design? So that the drainage has to be considered. And then you know, the curb elevations changes, the width changes, and all that other stuff. What we're looking at, and I asked Rick to look at, Rick is my assistant, Rick Williams, he's working with her, is to maybe look at putting the sidewalks property tight so that any difference in grade elevation in the street with the final plan will be absorbed in the swale. So yeah, something like that. I mean, we want to have the full plan so we know where to put everything. And you know that, so.
Right. Now, one of the things that precipitated what we were looking at is this gentleman here lives down in Madras, and they've done such a fantastic job down there, ODOT and Madras, to come up with a landscape treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And so we saw how that was done, and we said, wow. And it has the higher curbs. They're like 14, 15 inches high. And it has little flue channels within them where it runs in and it takes the waters and it distributes them off the roadway into the
right,
into the drainage thing.
He's looking at the south end in front, which you're right. Doing right now in front of the
right. I was thinking
about something like that out
exactly.
Here.
Exactly. I'd say Madras is a model for what we like to see because they work very well with us. We had meetings with Gus, and we had a guy dedicated to that, Bill Hilton, out of my office. who went up and met regularly, and they came up with a plan, and they got the money to execute it, and it looks really good.
It does. And it looks wonderful.
What we envision, how to work with the city.
That's what we'd like to see, something similar. Mm-hmm. And I know there's different soil types here, different elevations, different differences. But to the extent possible, that looked like a wonderful
template. Yeah, we agree.
We'd like to get the same grant. What's that? Is that a TG? I don't know what's doing this.
Yeah, it was
a
teacher grant. Huh? Transportation enhancement.
Transportation enhancement grant.
So those grants are just out on the street now.
Right, I saw that, and I sent him an email today. But two things. One, if you take just the first street, I was thinking you're looking for some more money. Is there a way to take, you've got some ODOT bucket money, and since you look at your ODOT property there that has sidewalk, I mean, there's no sidewalks. Is there a way between that grant programs, Safe Route to Schools are a block away, could we connect over to Huntington, come from Huntington up to the highway, because that's where the schools are, get that, get in front of your whole, do that whole corner, but maybe $500,000 of it comes out of that whole thing, and then that starts this thing down through town. Mm-hmm. Then the next cycle maybe, or we do one now for the whole thing. The city wants to go out here and do here, we're at the south end, we get that north end, but then ultimately we got five blocks in between, or four blocks, whatever, they're long blocks, but to do that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's how to know when to do what, and how do you tie all these buckets, and the way you guys, it seems like to me there's a lot of money in bikes, trails, sidewalks, and that kind of stuff, because, you know, in Madras, they were doing Fairgrounds Road right now. That's $500,000 project. Well, they got them going all ends of town, and it's all sidewalk stuff coming from ODOT. Yep. So somewhere in Lapine, I can't walk on the sidewalk anywhere to go anywhere.
Right.
So we need to somehow get connected in and start, because it does take 2 or 3 years for these, or 4 or 5.
Cycle,
so
right.
We need to, I don't know how to, we got our corridor plan, that, you know, you've heard it, the people are frustrated, we get enough plans. We've overplanned, we've done our plans, but we got our plans. We see these nice colored things here. How do we go to that next step?
How do we acquire money to get to those steps?
To do.
Well, and I suspect that, I mean, it's just a matter of priority. You know, I suspect there's enough cost detail in what Joe put together for you to be able to say, you know, I'm going to pick off 3 blocks. I'm going to pick, you know, what, right. You know, whatever that distance is, because this is most important, because I, you know, we own the property in front of City Hall, and that's where we want to make our statement, and we're north from there, or we want to work south from Burson Reed, or, you know, however right. You do it, just pick it up, submit it.
Well, we should be doing that from first, I would think, from first to Reed, because that you've got money to do the intersection, you want the traffic signal, and that's our entrance to the town when you're coming from that way, and that's, we can work a little out here.
Is there someone that can help us put together that grant?
Yeah, John Condon.
Because it's a pre-app first, and then
right.
It's kind of a...
C-O-N-D-O-N.
He's our local agency liaison.
And really, with ODOT's property, I mean, we should be able to tie in with you guys, because you know, you've got the worst corner in town.
We don't own that property.
Well,
we would appreciate your backing and help to obtain it, because then we could trade it off and get out of town.
Yeah, yeah. Who called? Someone called me on that to try to talk. Is it you? Somebody.
Yeah, it's BLM. It's BLM. I talked to you once before about when they were doing all the other BLM trades. And
the theory is getting the BLM to, right now, so it's owned by the feds, so they lease it. So if they were to get title, just like we're going to get title to the rodeo grounds and, you know, other stuff.
Through a conveyance act.
Yeah, that's right. So if they could get title, we'd support them getting title.
Right.
Then, because we really don't want them to stay, that needs to be understood when you do this, because you don't want to feel cozy. Then they have something to trade, and we could get them out in the industrial park, maybe.
Right.
They could cross Reed, and now that it's signalized, the snowplows could come in and out, clear, and they've moved off a lot in other towns that way.
Yeah, okay. Well, a couple of times. Lincoln City was one. Developer came in and said, that's a great piece of property. He said, you find this piece of property, build this facility, you can have this piece. They worked it out. There was another one in the works, and there's another one proposed right now. I just talked to a bunch of different
But you're leaving. Today. You're leaving Downtown Sisters, you're moving out.
Right.
You were right at the 9726 junction in Madras, and we used to give them an award. We would take photos of their place. It had
green
a green, ugly building. We used to take photos of it, and we would always put it up on stuff and say, welcome to Madras, and here's our friend ODOT.
Well, we browbeat him out. Sale on some surplus.
We browbeat him out of town. But Sisters is moving
him out. We like him. We don't want to browbeat him out of town.
No, we want him just
as far.
Yeah, has anyone approached Leahy yet on the site for ODOT there?
No, but Pat had called me, and I think it's a great idea to get the feds to trade them the land, and they have something to trade, and then that corner is part of our commercial. Ties us into our Huntington.
Right.
Do we have to start that process as the city, or do you,
well,
does ODOT start
We do,
that
but
process?
It helps a lot if the locals are backing it. You know, we'll start to support you.
We've got politicians that can help in that, too, because we're using them right now in this Land Conveyance Act.
You bet. I'd like to get tied into that.
I wonder if it can get to...
We do have some nice property to trade them.
I wonder if it could be added.
No, I don't think so.
On this latest conveyance, it's almost done.
Right.
Yeah.
They're working on it today in
DC. Yeah, in DC. I got to write a letter today.
We'll get another one started.
Yeah.
You know, it really helps now. Okay, so Rick hit it on the head. We were in Madras. We didn't want to be there anymore. But it helped a lot that the city piped up and said, we don't want you there. And the way politics work, you know, our higher-ups have to hear it from your higher-ups. It doesn't work so good if I say it, because I'm just an employee. So anyway, eventually, the pressure was on, and we got our bumped up on the list, in the statewide list of facilities. What happened in Sisters, we were on Forest Service property right in the heart of town. They wanted to sell the property. We had a lease. They said, time to leave. We went to the legislature when they were in session with an emergency. We got this. I asked them to write the letter. I said, make it real pointed. He did. Took the legislature. They said, oh, they're kicking you off. We've got to get you some money. So they did. I envisioned that we could do this here with the city saying, we don't want you there any longer. We'll support you moving to the industrial area or whatever makes sense. Right now, just off the top of my head, industrial area kind of makes sense. We just need to help to get the BLM to trade us the land, because we have some properties on the John Day River that they're using under permit from us as a park. We've got several other pieces that are surrounded by BLM that we would just assume we don't use them. They could use it. We could use this piece.
Well, they trade you for John Day River in a second.
No, we tried that. And they said, oh, it's not worth that much. And I said, what? Riverfront property is not worth much?
Yeah, thanks.
So anyway, that kind of fell off the table. I don't know who was doing the assessment, but... We disagree.
The bottom line in this, folks, is the First Street realignment for that intersection before that light can go in and everything be done, that issue needs to be resolved.
Yeah.
Okay. Because we'll be dealing with BLM to get the piece of property that you need for that intersection anyway. I mean, one of the solutions goes across.
Maybe that helps open up the discussion.
That's what I'm thinking is, rather than taking a piece, let's see. See if we can't get the whole thing. And then we can deal with the city.
I don't think they would object to that if you think about it. Why would they want it? They're not using it. They've got an ODOT group on there that, you know, I would think that it would be one much different than the problem with the reason this was only like 800, hundreds of acres and it's out in the forest. You know, I think that's
It's a 10-acre parcel, but about an acre and a half is across the street, that little triangle of trees over there by the development. So we're talking about 8.5 acres, 8 acres, if you include the highway. Highway goes across it. The assessment for the commercial value is the only part that worries me. I don't know what they'll think about it, but we don't need to be in town with a cinder pile and a bunch of equipment next to the shopping center. And you know, it's we're not suitable there anymore. We were at one time, but we would like to move also, and would like your support to do that.
How much land do you need for a facility?
Probably about 8 to 10 acres.
For a long term?
That gives us a little more.
For a long term?
Long term, right.
That's enough?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that gives us room to expand if we need to, and if we don't, well, then we can trade it off to something
else. Do you have where you're at?
Right now it's about 8 acres.
Okay.
Right where we are.
But you're hodgepodge.
Right.
Well, we are. And
kind of, you know, old buildings, and you've added trailers, and then you're across the road with
right
or whatever.
Right.
The reason I'm asking that question is, if you're there for 20 years and you get 8 acres today and 15 years from now you need another four, why not get it now and have it for when you need it?
Right, right. And we consider all that. We figure on a 50-year minimum plan.
Okay.
You know, our ODOT doesn't plan on building any new roads. They figure they got all the miles they're going to have for the next 100 years.
I worked for a county for too long. That doesn't work.
Well, most of our maintenance stations have been around, let's see, since the 30s. And you know, we plan on being, you know, we don't like to move very often. It's pretty expensive. So.
Okay.
We try to locate such that we won't interfere with future uses.
So would a letter of recommendation coming from this council be of use, maybe even letters to state senators?
Well, let me get started. Yes, it would be of use. But let me get started first so we have somebody to talk to.
Otherwise, the letter wouldn't have anything to go with. It's kind of like they're going to have to initiate that they want to do this with the BLM.
So they'll initiate something with us?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because the BLM's going to have to come look at it. Have you ever actually had many formal discussions?
You know, I've brought it up several times, but we've never sat down and really made it happen.
Yeah.
It's just the time.
And there's all new folks over at the Prineville BLM.
Yep. And the other thing that might be helpful is that Community Solutions team, the governor's team, their backing would help a lot. We need to get their support. But we need to initiate it, and I'll start that. I'll start the process.
Because it could take you 5 or 10 years to get this accomplished.
Well, how long did the one take that you're just completing?
Oh, that's been going on for about 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it was a lot of acres. Your battle will be this value battle.
Right, exactly.
The BLM, under their federal rules, because I've worked on this, including, funny, some with the John Day River, and they come in, they're going to value that and call it maybe, you know, well, it is, it's commercial, it had a new signal.
Right.
So then they're going to say it's worth, you know, $2 or $3 million for that land, you know, 100,000 acres or something to who knows, but it's going to be a
land
bunch.
Values are down now compared to right. 5 years ago.
Right.
Remember that.
Right. But still, 100, I mean, basically $2 a foot makes it $1 million. Mm-hmm. Give or take. But so anyway, then they're going to go back, then they're going to put $1 million value, then they're going to go over on the John Day River and they're going to do this 100 acres or 50 acres or 20 acres and they're going to say it's rangeland even though it's along the river. Then they're going to give it a $50 an acre value and then you're $950,000 short in value. And they, by law, they have to do a value for value trade. It's why on the John Day River, for any of you ever go over there, we just lost a public put in basically because they got in a upset deal with a rancher trying to do a land trade and they put these dumb values. It was riverfront right along the John Day to launch boats and they gave it rangeland value, which is like $50 an acre.
And that didn't make good
and the
sense.
Guy, and the rancher said, you've got to be kidding me.
Yep.
So it's complicated.
You know, let me insist though, you've been there a long time, you've got a lot of equipment, oils, chemicals, wouldn't it be a brownfield site?
No, it wouldn't be a brownfield site. It's been cleaned up, but before we leave any site, we have to make sure it's clean, pass all the tests with DEQ and everybody in the world. So we are right away. All of our money for moving takes care of those issues.
Okay.
You know, we have to dig up and have tests.
Yeah, they're a brownfield site. He's going to put that on the tape recorder.
No. Emphatic no.
We need the EPA to come clean them.
I love it.
That takes place with every project we do, whether it's ours or whether we're buying an old house or gas station for a road.
I see.
But Oregon's really strict about that, and you know, that's pretty serious about it.
Pat will eat some of the dirt before they move out.
That's on the record, by the way. Yeah, that's a finding. Now, he looks like he's got a lot of fortitude, so he'll be able to withstand the rigors of eating that stuff.
Yeah, he'll eat anything.
I think that'd be a good idea to get that started, because it's going to take a while.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your support.
Thank you.
Any other comments on it?
Just thanks for you guys all coming down and all of you, ODOT and Kittleson, and we'll be seeing Joe a lot.
I'd like, well, one thing, could I get the name of the BLM person you're working with on land trades and I can make contact with them?
Oh,
it used to be.
I could find out from our park district director. I don't have that name right at hand.
Wasn't Phil Paterno, was it?
Not that I recall. We've been dealing with a lady here lately.
Phil Paterno is not working in that position anymore. There's a guy named Doug Vandergon. And then there is a lady, Christine. I got it in an email somewhere. But it would seem that if you've been on that property on a lease, that you should be able to patent that since you've fulfilled all your obligations on that recreation and public purpose lease to be there. And that's what the I say that because the sewer district, and Kitty might remember, she's been here, you know, and been around it, but the sewer district is on the property it's on now, and then patented that when he got ownership of it. And it might be something that could just be handled in the criminal office rather than having to go to Congress like we're going through to the courthouse and the radio.
Especially if they get a reasonable value on their own property.
You know what, may not even be happening with the trade. You may be able to just claim ownership because you fulfilled all your requirements.
We can get somebody's name to you to get the ball rolling.
Rick has my email address.
Okay.
Doug Vandergon's who I work with.
And you know, the other thing sometimes that you
sir,
you might take the job. You know, you sit down, and we could do, you know what, Pat, when I come through, because I have to come through Bend, obviously, to come here all the time, you and I could go down and meet with Greg Walden's administrator. Because they know where's the best way to start. And you know, who are the people over in the BLMD to start with? I think that Nick would know, because they do this all the time.
Okay, is it Nick Strader?
Nick Strader, yeah, do you know him?
No.
He's Greg Walden's regional man, and then...
How do you spell his last name?
S-T-R-A-D-E-R. I mean, I have him in my cell phone, but, call Nick, but he's right downtown Bend there, but I think... Then they'd say, who's the best person? You know, otherwise you make that first phone call over there and you end up with someone way down the food chain.
Oh, and yeah. The wrong track. Yeah. Misdirected.
Yeah, and we may want to start it above the person that's working it on this. Just get going.
Well, visit with them and drop your name. Say it. Have them give you a call. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay, we're ready to move on to other business. Is there any other business?
I have one question for you people. Is there any proposal on the part of Lapine north of Wickiup Junction in regards to your corridor plan?
Well, the work Joe did was focused basically between 1st and 6th. Okay.
I mean, that's part of Lapine too.
Yeah, we have a separate project up there to deal with the rail crossing, which of course...
I understand that. The reason I'm asking you, and most of all that business is all on the east side because the railroad's on the west side. And I didn't know if there was anything there that has been proposed, thought of, something we need to look at in the future.
No, I would think what you'd want to do is, as you go through the transportation system plan process, you know, we've got the project up there, the rail crossing, and then look at that stretch from north of the project limits, and you know, identify what your issues are and propose solutions. So I use the DSP process to get at that stuff.
Okay.
And that rail crossing's got to have so much clearance. I mean, you're taking that road up for so long that by the time you get back down, you might be addressing a lot of the issues you currently have.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to impact somebody in that area, I'm sure, when that comes about.
When you look at that, because you know, the Timber Garber and all that Schwab area through there is one that we've wanted to address for a long time. It's a major undertaking, and the touchdown of the bridge, you know, the bridge ramp didn't get far enough north to deal with it. And we talked to the city council, I think it was last year, about the whole project. In order to, you know, if you were going to actually run that far north, you'd be cutting off access, and the lots aren't that deep. You'd end up basically buying out that first tier of lots, and there's a lot of businesses there. And we didn't want to be involved in shutting down a lot of businesses without a better plan. So we just left that piece alone for the time being.
Okay.
Any other new business that we need to discuss? Or
I'd like to bring something up, if I may. This is under the City of Lapine budget for 2012-2013. And reading in here, it says, the city councilors offer for the budget committee's considerations. One of those priorities, and it's number one, is something I think should have gone through this committee first. That is the acquiring of 8 streetlights, part of the city's effort to eliminate major streets for safety and connectivity purposes. It's proposed the city purchase 8 streetlights at a very reduced rate of $1,300 per light standard. It probably should go through this committee before it goes to a budget committee. And also, installation of the BMX track to include a light pole, porter potty, and a drinking water source. The light pole would be one of the 8 noted above. And if we're going to get 8 streetlights for $97 or to illuminate, I don't understand about a BMX track. Probably should be done by a service club project rather than financed by the city anyway. I just thought I'd bring that up.
Okay, and let me just throw some comments. The budget committee, the first the councilors, and they have to do this each year, is identify their goals, and they identified their goals through a public process. And then subsequent, the budget committee met, reviewed the goals, and approved the goals. And so it's pretty well done in terms of here are the priorities, and here are the goals, and here's a money allocation. But understand that just because they have sort of approved these projects or packages in concept, doesn't mean that how they're employed or deployed has been determined. Okay, for instance, the council has just generally said we're going to acquire 8 luminaries because it's important that we start to have more light in our community for safety purposes. But heaven's sakes, we have no idea where those should go or how that should be considered. And I agree with you. Where they go and how that should be considered should come before this group. And with respect to a BMX track, likewise, they're saying, hey, you know, we want to do something for our youth, and we're probably going to apply this, go to the youth and ask them what they want instead of us telling them how they should have it, because we'll miss the mark. But where it'll be and how it'll be and what it'll be is certainly something to come here too. All right. All we wanted to do was say, because we're on a real tight schedule for delivering to the state what our budget is, and I've only been here, I'm just a 90-day wonder. And day one I got here, I start work on the budget. We've gone through it in 90 days, and imagine trying to get it all out in that time was really a challenge, but also to throw goals in there too was a real challenge. And so I think in the process, some processes that normally would be attended to got discounted, such as your consideration. I can assure you in the future, we're going to work you folks to death. That's a promise.
And can I address the streetlights a little bit?
Yes, sir.
Because that will be a brand new contract that between the city and Midstate that has to be gone through, because the last one was a 3-party agreement and it will not work with the new lights. And so we don't know what the actual cost is going to be, installed cost, and that was a guess.
By the way, we bumped up that cost based on that breakfast the other day. I added another $4,000 to the cost consideration.
That'll buy one light.
I got to pay for the lunch on Saturday.
You got to take care of the Midstate employees, Steve.
Yeah.
I well, just got to keep everybody
we
happy.
We take care of our own here, Steve.
All right. You know, I think, Bill, and because we, too, because that's a good point, and I think he answered it well in the sense he just got here. This committee also, this is just our third meeting. It was kind of hard to come in here 2 months ago at our first meeting and start saying, do you think we should buy 6 or 9 lamp posts? I mean, you know, you wouldn't have anything to even base it on, hardly. So I think that
right.
As we move down, Now, you know, so they got money for some of that. So then you can help discuss.
Yeah.
Do you want them where you want them, or do you agree with where someone's recommending to put them? And you can kind of put your stamp, yes or no. Staff will kind of work on a lot of these things, but I think that a year from now it'll be a little different as you get into all these planning processes and things. So we're kind of being educated at this point.
Yes.
Why don't we do this? We have now 17 goals for next year, and some of those are with this board. So why don't we have for the next meeting just an evaluation of those goals and which ones you think ought to be with you and how you think you might play a role in those, and we'll go from there. Okay.
I got two comments on the streetlights. The style that we've selected on Huntington Road, would that work at 97 at all? I mean, they're 16 and a half feet high.
I don't think so, but that's my assumption.
It depends what you're trying to do. Is it
light up pedestrian?
Yeah, so you might be able to, you know, provide some benefit for pedestrian crossings. So you want to think about, you know, do I have pedestrians that cross the highway at night? Where do they cross? You know, you want to get that sort of baseline information. We probably wouldn't want to maintain anything that wasn't our standard, because we can't maintain, you know, every jurisdiction's, you know, we can't stock that, you know, keep that stuff in stock. So it would be a more likely for the city to maintain, or if it was on franchise agreement with state or whatever. No. So
where are these eight lights coming to?
We don't know. We just said we're going to cover. We're going to have eight out there, for heaven's sakes, and then we'll figure out where to put them.
At this point, it looks like we're putting them in inventory to have on hand for when we want to place them. Is that correct?
Yeah, and you know, I leave it up to you folks to decide where you want to put them. You know, if you leave them up to me, I'm going to put them all out in front of my house in Crescent Creek.
Well, it's one of the things I did notice on one of the slides that Joe had, was he actually had that style light. And so if it was approved and the city was willing to pay for the energy usage at 97, would ODOT pay any portion of electricity costs and city, mid-state maintain the lights?
No, but we probably would object to them putting them on our right of way.
Okay.
Maybe this is stupid. Is there a way to have a solar street light?
Or there are. I'm not sure how effective they are. We have
right now.
Yeah, for 150 watts, you have to have a pretty good sized solar cell. And then it only works if the sun's shining. So you got to plan, have battery storage when the sun's not shining. So.
Right. The other reality, and then, we're trying to, you just talked about how what it looked like in Mathers being good. Believe me, that was well thought out and planned. The same lights are from one end of town to the other. You just can't go out and throw up six lights on a corner.
That's right.
Because otherwise, when you go to do the sidewalks and the swales, nothing's where it needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's okay to save that $5,000 or $10,000 if you don't use it this year. You know, and now if you're off over in a subdivision, you're going to put street lights on poles to light up our neighborhoods.
Right.
That's a different deal. But on this corridor, and even Huntington, that, and down First Street, that triangle, basically, which is our highway corridor, our downtown corridor, and then the connection, we really need to do a plan. I mean, not even our planning, but whatever it is, it needs to be
consistent.
Yeah, and because, you know, you're going to want plug-ins at the street trees. Well, it's the same power line you're running down to run up to the power light pole. It's the same power you're running into the street trees so you can put lights on them. You saw this plug-ins in the Mathers trees. You know, you can't go out right now if you don't have money to go put in tree wells. You know, so I don't know. I don't believe on Highway 97 that you can piecemeal this. This has to be, and it'll, they'll cringe. It just isn't going to work.
Right.
So as far as going out buying five or six street lights, and even thinking they're not coming near 97, I don't see it happening. You know, we've got the corridor plan. We need to go apply for the some of these grants, work through this person, and decide maybe you go from first to third or do three blocks, and we get in there. I think we could get some money. We have never got any of that because we're a new city. So, you know, and part of it borders ODOT property. ODOT helps review them, you know. You know, and First Street's a priority in their system. It's on their DSP, kind of. So all of this ties together. It may be that lamppost. But in that process, they'll figure out whether you need a 20-footer, 16-footer. They're acorn lights, and they're all kinds of shapes. And I can tell you right now, Mattress is already wanting to change. One thing they'd like to change, they want a water pipe up them so you can put the pots baskets that are colorful.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And so the difference is one's a metal pole, one's a fiberglass pole, and the strength of the pole, which is the footing of the pole. If you're going to put two baskets out there, the leverage at 20 feet is unbelievable, and then you have to have a little tube going up. But it's the same tube that's going to water your street tree. So that when you run, you know, this is all very complicated and expensive.
We need to have a meeting for that.
And I think we're only going
to
do it once.
We need to go with this meeting that we're talking about because we've got the enhancement. The governor solution team, do they have anything to do with this?
It's been portrayed to me is that they are helping hands and that they will take their power and their imaginations and help us to the extent that we ask them the right questions.
Well, okay. Then maybe we need to meet before they come so we could kind of have
we
a heads
surely
up.
We surely can.
Okay.
We can. I'm willing to, in fact, Kitty's left already, but I talked to her the other day about, well, you know, why don't we just put all of our heads together and think about what it is we want
right.
to talk to.
Long term, so that what we put in here is going
to... Yeah, and we don't want to have too many things on our plate, but four or five things that are doable, that make sense, that we can put some timelines to. Like, for instance, one that just kind of pulled itself out today is maybe the relocation of that brownfield site.
We were doing good in the city space until then.
So it sounds like your next meeting you're going to spend a lot of look over these transportation goals, the things that are in the budget, and start. And of course, things will pop up over the next month too, and maybe we'll be able to come back on this whole sidewalk grant program.
Yeah, maybe we'll have some luck there.
And Kitty's back.
Kitty, we talked about you while you left.
Mm-hmm. I anticipated that.
I couldn't believe the things that were said.
I'm sure I would.
That's all we have, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. That's everything, then I move
to be. I would just like to say I really appreciate all of you coming here. This is really, I mean, for me, it's all brand new information, and for some other people, it's current updates or relearning some things, and I really love the participation of Kitty and Julie to come every meeting, and Scott and our Tim. It really is going to make a big difference, because if we get accurate information and accurate knowledge, we can go out to our own other spheres all around. Because nobody has a clue as to how much planning and the process and all this, you know, we just get all this bad stuff information going and we don't get the accurate ones. So it's really, really nice of you, and we appreciate every minute you come and spend with us.
No problem. I guess one other thing, would it be possible for ODOT to bring down the plan for the railroad crossing? At a future meeting?
Yes, we'd like to.
We can put that on our agenda. There's a person that's in charge of that. Yeah, and just make sure something else comes
with. We'll find out next meeting.
Well,
Tim will come. He's good that way. Oh, yeah.
And we can't forget Scott. Thank you so much, too.
Thank you.
Okay, if there's no other comments,
I make a motion that we adjourn.
I'll second it.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? So moved.
Thanks.